Hi everyone, I'd like to welcome you to the Austrian Circle. This is the program where we talk about the economics of freedom here on WHUS Stores 91.7 FM. So I'd like to thank you very much for tuning into my show this morning. I'm your host, Racker, and I have a very special guest on the show this afternoon. I've told you that I wanted to get more interviews on the show, and I've been trying to deliver that. So I have a great guest. His name is Rob McNeely. Rob, welcome to the show.
Hey, Eric. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with me today.
Great. And Rob's been in the field for much longer than I have. I really joined up with the Ron Paul movement in about 2008 or so, and so I've been doing this show here at the station for about 4 years now. And I'm a little bit of a newbie compared to Rob. Rob's been working in politics, working to move libertarian agendas into the mainstream for about 20 years now. Is that right, Rob?
Yeah, I've been politically active and, as some people would say, awake probably much longer than most people have. I've kind of got turned on to the ideas of liberty and freedom about when I was about 20 years old. I got involved with freedom through the property rights movements in Michigan during the mid-90s. And back then, we didn't have social media. We didn't even have DVD players back then. How ideas were being exchanged were VHS tapes. And I can clearly remember the first time I really started getting the pieces put together for me that things aren't necessarily right or as we've been taught in public schools in the United States. Growing up, I was always kind of a skeptical guy. I always kind of thought that there's just something not right about the way things are run around here. Everything just kind of, you know, you hear and you're conditioned through the media and through public institutions and government that, you know, everything's great. We're the land of the free. We're milk and honey and opportunity abounds for everybody. But that never jived with what I saw on the streets growing up in Metro Detroit. I found people regularly getting run over by government bureaucracy, and that got me kind of questioning things. And I think many people in the liberty movement, once they get curious and maybe even get run over themselves by the bureaucracy and the statism that we live under, they really start questioning everything and then start really kind of exploring. Once you lose your taboo of fearing normal institutions and paradigms, and you start questioning things, it can take you down many rabbit holes.
Absolutely, and I think people going into business might be very familiar with what it is that you're talking about. I just watched a documentary recently, which I plan on playing on the air fairly soon. It's about people who wanted to braid hair and the business that they wanted to set up. They were continually squashed by the cosmetology regulations that were in the area. They weren't able to bring about the business that they were trying to see without something like $10,000 and years of school and all of this stuff that the government, the people who wanted to maintain a monopoly in the market, put into place to keep those entrepreneurs really from getting into the market. So they want to limit competition. They want to create a monopoly for themselves so that they can raise prices, they can decrease quality, and overall not really benefit the consumer all that much.
Well, I think if I was going to talk to someone who's never been exposed to libertarian ideas and try to explain where kind of libertarians and voluntarists and anarchists kind of come from, is the fact that the system that we live under is really kind of a series of systems, really. And they're designed, really, corporations, government is a tool by which corporations use to move wealth from private sector hand to public sector hands. In other words, government is a tool that corporations use to take money from taxpayers and turn it over to politically connected corporations, unions, foreign governments, and dictators and special interest groups. And it sounds really hokey and it sounds like conspiracy theory-ish, but when you really start looking at it, everything revolves around people making money and people using government to limit money from flowing away from certain connected organizations. And once you realize it, I challenge anyone listening to this that even if you think it's a far, right-wing conspiracy theory view of government, go look at any regulation out there. And really, every regulation out there generally serves one purpose, and that's to, make rich or make richer politically connected individuals, groups, and special interests. And once you understand that, everything else makes a whole lot more sense.
And it really does make sense. I mean, if you had a money tree just kind of growing in your backyard and you just went out there and were able to harvest it all the time, I'm sure that anybody listening to this would be very happy to go and do so. Well, you can think of the government as a money tree. They go to the government, they get them to sign certain laws into place which benefit them, and then they are able to harvest money from the taxpayers. And it's a dispersed cost, but it's a centralized benefit. So the people who are special interests get the benefits, and the people who have to pay for it, they only have to pay a couple cents, a couple dollars here and there, and so they don't really see the cost that is accruing to them. But the people who are especially interested, they certainly see the benefit. And what really got me into this movement was the Federal Reserve, was the money. And once I realized that that system was consistently a system of fraud meant to siphon money away from the general population, you can think of prices rising, meaning that our dollars are getting less valuable. Value is being siphoned away from the customer, from the people who are holding on to those dollars. And once I understood that, I delved much deeper into what governments actually do. And what you're describing is absolutely correct, Rob.
And it's frightening and scary all at the same time. The fact is, the entire system is rigged against you from day one. You know, most people go to public government schools, and so they're fed a certain line of propaganda that reinforces the state control mechanism. The media reinforces it. Come on, how many times have you heard, on the media and from the president and schools, let's take, the economy. We've been in a depression now for 5 years, 6 years, since at least 2008. It's not really getting any better, but yet every time you turn on the TV, they're like, the recovery, recovery, it's all nonsense. Here's another myth, and I believe, look at the education bureaucracy and establishment. It's another part of the Federal Reserve in many ways. And I remember growing up, and when I was going to government schools, they said the only way you could make it in society is to go to college to get a good job. You've probably heard that yourself, right? You got to get a good education. Well, the only way you can afford to get an education is to get a student loan. For many people. In my case, it was a student loan. I had to take out lots of student loans. But yet, you never hear the fact that, the banks have gotten, had special legislation passed so that they could never have their borrowers bankrupt out of their student loans. The taxpayers will pick up the tab if they do.
It's a lender of last resorts, and so whenever the banks run out of money, when they pass too many loans, when they take all these risky endeavors and they send all this money out to people who really can't afford in the long term to pay these loans back, it's the taxpayers that then bail them out. The government just takes money from everybody else, or they just print money, which is the same thing. I mean, it's exactly the same thing. They siphon value away from people towards the banks, towards the special interests. And it's really a revolving door of constant theft on the general population.
But look at the I don't know if you want to call them unintended consequences, but the consequences of essentially taking the risks out of lenders, in this case, major banks, who are in the student loan business, the student loan industry. And that's happened a couple different ways. One, you got a large section of the population taking out a large amount of debt that in many cases they'll never be able to pay off. But in addition to that, they can't bankrupt out of it. And the other problem is that because the banks have no risk themselves for loaning money out, they're incentivized to issue as many loans as possible to anybody, regardless of their ability or intention or credit score to be able to, pay these loans off. So what happens is, since anybody can get a student loan, people take out student loans for all sorts of educational opportunities like degrees that historically never pay off very well. There's certain social studies types, sociology and, some of the soft sciences that many of these jobs never make a lot of money anyways, but yet, it might be a job that you can make 30 grand a year off of, but you get, off the $100,000 of student loans to get there. And so what ends up happening is the free availability of all this liquid cash has driven up the cost of education to the point where you have no choice but to take out a loan to even get a degree. I live here in Salt Lake City, Utah now. And I have a friend of mine that owns a local college, a for-profit college, and they do not accept Title IV education financing. They're not accredited enough by the federal government to actually accept student loans. So for this one college to get a LP, to, you know, licensed or to be an LP nurse program is only $7,000 to $8,000. Now, their main competition in town, and I won't use any names, another for-profit nursing kind of teaching school, for the same program, charges almost $80,000. And for that, and the ability why they can do that is because that other school accepts Title IV financing and student loan money. So they can charge whatever they want. They get the student loan to pay for it, and people who are not educated that have been taught their entire lives by the school system that you got to get a good education to get a good job. And so it's kind of the self-fulfilling prophecy. So on one hand, the bankers own, the banking corporations own the government to pass legislation that favors them. And then the same government that runs the schools tell everybody that they got to go and go to those schools to make it anywhere in life. And that's what they're taught to very young, impressionable children. And so to me, it's perverse. And that's just, you know, the education establishment is just one of many, many examples. If you look at our society, we have a tainted culture. And you'll see the same corruption, collusion, and conflicts of interest permeate every aspect of American life.
Yeah, and I like what you were talking about the two businesses that are pretty close to each other, except that one accepts federal government money and the other does not. And in economics, we can't really test too many things. We don't have like a room that we can bring two businesses into and see the differences and kind of change a variable and see what actually happens. But what you're describing is kind of a little microcosm, and we see that when the federal government injects all this money, then prices go up. I mean, we can see that in the medical industry as well. Medicare, Medicaid, all of these organizations that siphon money into that medical branch of things, we see prices going up and fairly rapidly, too. I mean, it's immense how quickly prices are rising in that area. Nobody ever asks why are prices rising. They just say, well, we need to get the government to fix things. We need to pass all these laws and things like that. But they don't stop and go back and really kind of realize that the government is the reason why those prices are rising so high in the first place.
And you're exactly right. And just like with the student loan industry, when government made it risk-free, they just came in, distorted the market for education. They made it available to more and more people. They made the banks have a perverse you know, incentive to loan money to people that shouldn't get it and people that are studying degrees that aren't high-paying. To get them involved with, you know, taking out these massive student loans that they can't bankrupt out of. You know, if you wanted to fix the, you know, if you want to bring down the price of college, you can do it two ways. One, you can make people bankrupt out of, you know, and make bankruptcy an option for people that can't pay off their student loans. In turn, banks would have to limit, voluntarily, they would limit who they, you know, they start changing the criteria for who they're going to get money to because they may lose money. And then, you know, less money be available to people, to borrowers. And so, you know, the demand for college education would decrease slightly, so colleges would reduce their price. That's economics. Another way is just to get government out of backing all student loans altogether, I mean, which is kind of the same thing. And if you did that, you could bring education ultimately to more people because and you can have a much healthier economy because, you know, people aren't going to be strapped with all this debt. And, you know, it used to be you could literally work your way through college at nights with part-time jobs and through the summer. I know lots of people who did that, and they just, you know, they could afford it. Even when I first started college back in circa 1990, I'm dating myself, I went to community college, and I think I spent $500, $600, $700 a semester to go to community college back around 1991. But to go now, to go to the same community college is $2,000, $3,000, $4,000 a semester.
It's almost unaffordable if you don't get the student loans, and that's really what they're doing. And they're siphoning so many people through that industry that it really decreases the benefits that you see out of the college education. You know, if everybody in the entire world has a college education, then employers look at that and they say, well, everybody's got one. I mean, what's the value in hiring somebody that has a college education when everybody just has one. So it really decreases the value that you get from the college education out of school, in addition to raising costs so much. I mean, all you have to do is when consumers stop buying something, businesses draw their prices down so that they can entice buyers to buy those things. But when you have constant government influx of money going into these businesses, then they have no incentive whatsoever to reduce their prices, to try and draw new customers in, to try and improve the quality of their product. I mean, there's no reason for that whatsoever.
Right. And so you can take that same model and look at the healthcare industry and see, going back to the cost of healthcare versus the availability of money being flushed in the machine. So, for instance, back in the, you know, going back to the Medicare Act of 1965, I think that's where it really starts. Government started really meddling into healthcare. Prior to that, you hear these stories or anecdotes, at least my brother was born in the 60s, and my parents paid very little for his birth. It was less than $1,000, or he was like $600-700 or something. And my mom was in there for a week in the hospital, and it was only that much. Now you look, and, 2 days in a hospital with a normal birth is $5,000 to $7,000. And what's changed? And the fact is, you get the HMO Act of 1972, you get all these government regulations and Band-Aids after Band-Aids being put on all sorts of things like Medicare Part D and now Obamacare. And ultimately, when you got the government into the Medicare Act of 1965, prior to that, they were private charity hospitals across the country. And many of them were Catholic, but that's where you always see a Saint So-and-So church pretty much in every city. There used to be bunches of those. And what happens is those were charity churches, or charity hospitals, I should say. And what happened is when government got into providing charity through Medicare, things started changing. And what happened is that created competition for all these private charity outlets. And if you look, over time, government basically put private charity hospitals out of business by intervening in the market.
Well, it's funny. Somebody said the other day that, where's the market? Why don't they jump in and start providing roads? Why don't they jump in and start providing police? Why don't they, why doesn't the market come in and fill these gaps that you say are so important? If the monopoly product is not that good, then why don't businesses just come into the market and start doing stuff for us? And the reason is really when you have a subsidized product, when you have a product that is paid for by dispersed taxpayers throughout the entire country, what ends up happening is that you have a $0 price. There's absolutely no way that a business can compete with a $0 price. You can't say, hey, I'll charge you $2 when the alternative is what people perceive of as $0. And so whenever you get the government involved in things, it automatically is going to crowd out private industry in that particular area, whatever category that you're talking about, really.
Exactly. And you can just go on down the line, and when government provides a service, it tends to be more expensive. It tends to raise prices. But in the worst case is this corporatist model where government picks certain politically connected groups or organizations or corporations and give them their holy water blessing. And that's where it seems to get really, really ugly, is where, government gives benefits to the politically connected and everybody else is kind of footing the bill for it. And I think that's where it's making it so hard for small businesses to be successful pretty much across the country. And I believe that the future of this world is going to be fixed by the entrepreneur. It's going to be people that, in spite of government, still go out there and try to make a living on with their own hands and with their own minds and their own ideas and innovations. And I think we need to really focus on how to support that and kind of work around government instead of thinking that we're going to somehow, fix it or reform it to some way.
Yeah, and that's really what's happening in Denver. Denver's a very interesting scenario right now, I think, because the government is running out of money. They really can't do a whole lot in that city. And so what's happening is private industry, private business is popping up to fill the needs of what people demand in that particular area. They're building their own bus systems. There's even private defense companies out there who are willing to defend your property from thieves, from criminals, from people who are attacking you. And it's really interesting to see businesses pop up when the government goes away. They just say, hey, there's a demand. There's somebody that wants something. Let's pop in there and try to provide it. We'll see if they want to pay for it. If they do, then we'll continue, we'll expand. If not, we'll try something else, and we'll just figure out what people actually want. And
I think you meant Detroit, not Denver.
Sorry. That's you're out in Colorado, so I was thinking of Denver, but you are absolutely correct. In Detroit,
I'm kind of confused. I made you a little confused. I was born and raised in Detroit. I lived in Denver for 11 years, and I moved back to Utah 4 months ago. So I live in Salt Lake City now. I totally agree. You know, Detroit has been an interesting microcosm that there's all these basically anarchist businesses and people that are trying to basically run a gray market kind of business. And the government, instead of trying to fix the things that these private businesses and are trying, you know, these services that these private companies are trying to do, the government's trying to shut them down instead of trying to say, hey, obviously they got something figured out. Maybe we can figure, you know, maybe we can model what they're doing, because apparently they can make it work, but we can't. And the fact is, it's just government is probably the least efficient way to get anything done.
Well, they don't want the cat to get out of the bag. You know what I mean? They don't want people to realize that you can do something alternative to what it is that the state is providing. So they do want to shut that stuff down. They're also shutting down businesses that I think are very exciting, like these ride-sharing businesses that are, you know, they have maps online where you can just call somebody that's
Uber.
Right in that area. Yeah, all of those organizations, they'll come pick you up at your house, and they'll provide all these services to you. The government's trying to shut all of that down. I want to go back to corporations just for a minute, because I think that's one of the hardest things for people to kind of understand. They can't separate out corporations from the market. And corporations are really a product of government intervention. They have special privileges. They get benefits from the government. So I wondered if you could speak to that just a little bit.
Well, you got to remember, it seems to be, and I've, you know, been involved with government on a variety of levels through my life, and it seems that there's all sorts of special benefits and tax breaks and things given to politically connected corporations, but absolutely none given to small businesses that don't ask for a handout. So, for instance, I was very active in Aurora, Colorado, where I lived for a long time in the Denver area. And the City Council of Aurora has numerous times used the tool called economic development, or really economic development, a series of tools to try to, quote-unquote, attract jobs and businesses to move to the city of Aurora. Denver does it. Every major city does this kind of stuff. And the kind of shenanigans they did is Aurora is physically or geographically located to the east of Denver. And then the eastern border on the west side, and then the eastern border of Aurora is just the plains. It's just open prairie land, farmland and such. And so what's happening is Aurora keeps growing and annexing more and more land and expanding eastward out into the plains. And what's happening is there's a couple corporations that want to do developments, different kind of land developments, you know, high-rise convention centers, things of that nature. And so the city of Aurora has blighted special, you know, prairie land, raw land, never developed, undeveloped land, and they've used the state blight designation to make it so that these corporations can apply for special taxing privileges and get special kickbacks for urban development on the prairie. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of funny is that when you go back and look at it, the city of Aurora, and this is the one I'm really most familiar with, would pay outside third-party consultants tens of thousands of dollars to see if this raw ranch land met the checklist. There's so many checklists of blight conditions. Now, some of the blight conditions are: does not have adequate roads, does not have adequate sidewalks, unsafe walking conditions. I mean, I'm literally saying this.
Isn't that the government's role in the first place? Don't they say that they're the ones that are supposed to generate the roads? So isn't that their problem to begin with?
You know what? You can argue, yeah, it's not logical. But the fact is, the people that are running these corporations that want those special taxing privileges, you know, they take care of the politicians that take care of them. And I've seen it numerous times. And these, you know, they're willing to create special taxing districts. They're willing to do PIFs and TIFs financing and give, you know, tax, you know, decades worth of tax breaks for the people doing the development. Politicians get a kickback on the back end. And you see this over and over and over again. And this is one of the ways, it's one of the most insidious things you see, but this is how corporations get things done time and time again. You know, who's going to pay the bill? Oh, the people, who's actually going to afford, who's actually going to pay for those roads and those developments? Oh, that's going to be the taxpayers that are paying for those private developments. But yet, if I want to go get a tap fee for a private house, it's $20,000, $30,000 in the city of Aurora, Colorado. So that's the nonsense you see, is that you see corporations using government to basically get the expense of, or live at the expense of taxpayers. There was a, I'm not going to say which company, but there was a company I know in Aurora, Colorado, that was going to want to move a factory to the city of Aurora. And they were going to build some kind of widgets. And that company wanted a tax break to move there. And that company didn't go and knock on every door in the city of Aurora and say, hey, can you give me $5 and chip in so we can move here? No, they didn't do that. They went to the city council, and the city council approved the tax break and basically gave taxpayer money over to these guys to do all sorts of things. And you see this time and time again, and that's how corporations, and that's on a micro scale, how corporations across the country use government as a club to steal and graft from taxpayers. And it happens in every industry and at every level of government.
Yeah, it's pretty constant. And I think economic development is a kind of funny term. I wish they would call it by its real name, which is central planning. It's the government providing incentives, whether or not the consumer actually wants those businesses or those products involved in their lives. So as if the government knows better than anybody else in that particular area. So the way that the market would try that is it would start a small business there and it would say, hey, do people actually want to buy that? If they do, we'll move more people over. We'll continue to move that and see whether or not people actually want to buy that product. They'll just kind of dip their toe in it first, and they'll try and figure it out. But government encourages all these humongous moves, these humongous changes. And then when it doesn't work out or when the customer didn't actually want it, they just kind of, you know, shrug their shoulders and just say, well, that's too bad. You know, you just lost on that investment, you taxpayers, you. And I think that's a very unfortunate way of going about things.
Absolutely, and you know, and I don't have a good answer. I don't know the solution to, you know, to stop this kind of corruption, from the fact that, you know, the taxpayers themselves, the voters, are easily fooled or bribed by whatever the politicians are selling. So when it comes to most of these like economic development tools, politicians always go to the voters, say we're going to bring jobs and fix the economy. And for, I guess for the most part, it works. People believe them time after time after time, although ultimately it never ends up being that way. It doesn't end up creating usually more jobs. And usually the taxes that are either lost or invested in, you know, the schemes to attract these companies actually usually outweigh the good from the few jobs that actually are brought.
Yeah, I wish there was better solutions. I think maybe we can look a little bit to Detroit and see what's going on there. Once the government is bankrupt, then we can try and move more private industry into whatever areas that we need to provide for our own selves. Well, Rob, it was great having you on the show today. We're just about out of time, so thank you so much for coming on. I hope that we can do this again sometime because it was great.
Absolutely. If people want to know more, they can always go check out my website at robmcneely.com.
Excellent. Robmcneely.com. Rob, thank you so much for being on the show today. This has been another episode of the Austrian Circle. I hope that you tune in next week for another episode. Take care.